If you like playing in the field of possibilities and getting your information from those who really know, Conversation at the Cutting Edge is your kind of program. Host Sandy Sedgebeer speaks with teachers, speakers, scientists, and authors that are shifting perceptions about who we are and what we're capable of. Get ready to expand your awareness and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. Here's Sandy.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgebeer, and you're listening to Conversation at the Cutting Edge. If it's true that humans are wired to want and need love, why is it that the number of adults living alone has risen from 22% in the 1950s to over 50% today? Are we getting lousier at relationships, or are we just confused about love? Carissa Luminaire, PhD, graduated from Harvard in psychology and social relationships. A consultant and counselor, she spent the past 30 years pioneering educational programs focused on the integration of personality and soul. In her private practice, Carissa integrates her lifelong research on childhood attachment and how our early bonding patterns with our parents profoundly affect our primary adult relationships. Carissa Luminaire, welcome.
Thank you.
Carissa, you say that making a relationship work isn't rocket science, it's neurology, that the patterns for how we function in relationships are formed in our childhood bonding experiences. So it's not that we're lousy at love, we just learn to repeat the wrong patterns. Tell me more.
Yes. Most of the research that's come out in the last 20 years with over 2,000 studies on what happens in the attachment period when we're younger actually impacts our ability to and qualifies how we bond in our adult intimacy style. So neuroscientists, the neuroscience of relationship, has distinguished four types of programming we've received based on how responsive our caregivers were in co-regulating us when we were distressed, you know, whether they reassured our sense of safety with holding that felt secure and safe, the quality of the touch, the eye contact, and the soothing voices. Those are the primary languages of love. So I can share what those four styles are if you'd like.
Yeah, please.
So, again, depending on how consistently our caregivers co-regulated us, were there for us, we developed either being securely attached, which is a feeling of I can trust you, you'll be there, predictable, and I feel safe most of the time. They say 80% or more of the time is what defines secure attachment. In other words, a parent doesn't have to be perfect. They can be moody, have phone calls when the child cries or other kids. But the majority of the time in secure attachment, the caregiver is consistent enough in responding to the distress. So the child feels, you are predictable, love feels safe, I can depend on someone to regulate me and to calm me down quickly. And this creates a more independent, self-confident child. These are, of course, all generalizations. The other three styles are all in the insecure attachment distinction. There's three of them. In general, insecure attachment leaves the child feeling, I can't trust you'll be there. You're unpredictable. You're unavailable. You don't feel safe to respond to my distress. And those children eventually have a low expectation for getting a loving response, which often plays out in the kind of partners they choose later in life. The three insecure attachment styles are often called anxious insecure attachment. That one is when the caregiver is inconsistent in responding. The child feels like sometimes they're there when I'm in distress, sometimes they're not. So even when they're there, I'm anxious they could disappear on me. This is the parent who's kind of unpredictable. And it leaves the child often highly anxious. And often in an adult sense, they are the ones who are very kind of preoccupied with rejection and get very angry and resentful and nervous when their partner shows disinterest. They can often be more critical, and they're more the aggressors in a relationship. The second insecure attachment style that's very common is called avoidant attachment. That's when the love feels unavailable. For a child, the caregiver seldom, if ever, responds with being there when they're in distress, and the child has a poor ability to, kind of a low expectation to depend on the caregiver. Disengages, they withdraw, they even stop showing distress. And those are usually the adults, we call them the avoidants, who, when they're triggered, they withdraw. They move away, they get paralyzed, they kind of, you know, disassociate, and they have all kinds of stories, each of these styles. And they actually are a result of having parents that didn't care for them, who avoided them. And the third insecure attachment style, which not everyone has, and yet too many have, is called trauma attachment. It's also often called push-pull attachment in the literature. In essence, it's the scary parent, where the caregiver frightened, traumatized, disrupted the child in a scary way, and the child gets very dysregulated. Kind of this often alcoholism, abuse. The parent is really traumatizing and disorganizes the neurology of the child's ability to trust anyone can be there ever. And this often will create high reactions and kind of high vicious drama cycles with couples or children and parents as they get older, because there's a sense of, you know, you are very, very threatening to me, and the traumatized will go into a feeling of getting hyper-aroused if you show any signs of what happened to me when I was younger.
Would you say that, you know, those three categories are predominant?
The insecure? Yeah. Mm. The literature varies regarding what's really playing out there, both on a, you know, child development level as well as the adult intimacy manifestations. Certainly, those who feel that most of their bonding experience, they're left feeling threatened, walking on eggshells, fear of being abandoned or rejected is the primary feeling between themselves and the other, they're in the insecure spectrum, one of those three, or a combination. Some of us are hybrids, where we had one parent, or we're in a particular relationship where we feel secure, where there's a general sense of, when I'm in distress, you care and want to repair that with me. And then they'll go be in another relationship or with a different child or a different parent who's strongly in the insecure experience. So we can often be a blend, and different partners, different children can bring out different dynamics for us.
Now, you call your work and your website Confused About Love. Mm-hmm. So is it just a confusion?
Well, ultimately, that was a kind of an insight, an epiphany I had when I realized, after hearing so many stories in my counseling experience of people experiencing love mixed with, you know, a lot of toxic patterns of their parents, blame, shame, threat, you know, being controlled, suffocated, trapped, abandoned, that if I took all the stories away, whoever was a cause to create this overwhelming disconnect between two people, that bottom line, it was just a massive confusion how to be loved, how to give love, how to receive love, how to relate in secure, loving, predictable ways.
It's, you know, it's the most important thing in our lives, and yet it's the one that consistently we get so wrong.
Oh, for sure, for sure. You know, it's really quite simple, but yet most people don't realize that much of our programming is a result of past emotional wounds and patterning that is being triggered by apparently similar stimuli that's mostly happening subconsciously, this kind of vicious, unhealed movie that goes on with these core fears of being abandoned or rejected, primarily unimportant, not good enough, can't trust people. And it puts us into these strong, triggered reactions very quickly. It's often what's running much of the estrangement and the kind of the dynamics in the warring parts of the world, or the where the cultures are really, really, you know, fighting it out. It's a lot of that's happening in the brain, where the way the brain is communicating is causing very strong triggers.
Well, let's come back to the brain in a moment. You're listening to Conversation at the Cutting Edge. I'm Sandy Sedgby, and I'm speaking with Carista Luminaire about why we're all so confused about love. After the break, Carista will tell us how knowing our love styles can help us create better relationships, and how you can begin to rewire your brain, mind, and heart to have the relationship you want. We'll be back in a few moments. Don't go away.
What does your vivid life look like? What does it feel like to be living a vivid life every single day? How do you start? What's the first step for you personally to make the shift that you've been seeking? Find out now. Vivid Life. It's a happier, healthier, wealthier state of being. Get there today by following us on Facebook, Twitter, or subscribing to our free inspirations in your inbox at vividlife.me.
You cannot separate who you are and what you do from how you interact with the world. Marketing was never meant to be slick and soulless. If you're looking to build your personal or business profile and platform and connect with the audience that resonates with you and your message, visit www.sandysedgebeer.com and discover what 30-plus years of applying the science of resonance in international publishing, marketing, and conscious business development can do.
You're listening to Vivid Life Radio Talk Radio that connects you to the most current, optimistic, and inspiring conversations on the planet. Get ready to be catapulted into your happiest, healthiest, and wealthiest life ever. Go to vividlife.me. That's vividlife.me for details on our previous and upcoming conversations with the world's brightest minds sharing their wisdom for happier, healthier, and wealthier lives.
Welcome back to Conversation at the Cutting Edge. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with Carista Luminaire about why so many relationships go wrong and how knowing our own and our partner's love styles can help us build a secure, loving relationship. Carista, before the break, you talked about the neuroscience of relationship. Mm-hmm. Does this mean that our brains rather than our hearts are controlling us?
Yes, our brains are controlling our hearts. This was a really critical piece in my understanding as a relationship counselor, as well as working my own process that really came out of this 20 years of research. And I'm going to say things very simply, not in an academic, scientific way, but more a metaphorical way for the listener to understand. We have a higher brain and a primitive brain. The higher brain, which is often called the frontal lobes, is really that which defines kind of our pro-relational functions, our ability to have empathy, mutuality, reciprocity, when we fight, to hold and wait and listen and understand. And it's by nature and ability, it's able to collaborate. It's like going for the win-win. And then there's the primitive brain, often called the warring brain. It's the automatic part of our brain that hijacks this higher brain I just referred to. It's where the survival alarm is in the amygdala, in the midsection of the brain, which is where the fight, flight, and freeze alarm system is. And it's primarily anti-relational in the way it functions. When it feels threatened, it's where we often manifest the need to be right and attack and defend and shut down, kind of give up. And it's often what happens as soon as we feel our partner's doing something to threaten us, and it can happen in a split second. The fire alarm says, you are not a safe source for me. You are threatening me. It could be nonverbal, like your eyes rolling, remind me of my raging father. Or your mouth tight reminds me of my rejecting mother. The tone of your voice reminds me of my controlling, mother. And all these nonverbal and verbal cues that we're picking up on all the time, when our partner or our child or our friends or our colleagues are threatening us, they may not even know it. We suddenly feel like we're in danger, emotionally, physically, mentally, spiritually, and the automatic primitive brain will come in and create sensations. We feel it in our body first. It's that heart rate or somewhere, we have that settling, unsettling feeling in our stomach, and we want to run away. That's the flight response, and they're usually the avoidance, the ones who want to get away and shut down, or we want to fight, like, you are provoking me, you're scaring me, and I'm going to use my critical, blaming, kind of aggressive tone to make sure that you don't disappear on me because I'm needing this connection and you're threatening me. That's more the preoccupied, anxious type. And those reactions are running us all the time. When we go into the scary, traumatized experience, that's usually the freeze mode. So we had the fight, that's more the escalated anxious. We have the flight, that's more the avoidant, shut down, distant person. You probably all know yourself or others. And then the freeze is when we actually feel so frightened that we collapse and go more into this primitive reaction where we just kind of disassociate. And that's more the trauma bonding.
Wow. So, I mean, when you're in the middle of all this threat and everything is on red alert, is it really possible to think rationally?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's an excellent question. The neuroscience says that when we're hijacked in red, in other words, that person's dangerous versus we feel safe, we're in green with them, the left brain, actually the rational sense, does get hijacked when we go into that more primitive part of the brain, the lower brain. So our first need is to get ourselves in safe conditions. If we can't have a, we can't get into a commitment with our partner to report, hey, you're threatening me, or I'm overwhelmed, I'm flooded, which is what the avoidant would say, I'm overwhelmed, I want to disappear, and I'm going to disappear if you don't stop coming after me. Or the anxious saying, please pay attention to me, I'm getting anxious, you're abandoning me, and I'm desperate for connection. If we can't get that other person to care for our distress, then the next thing is we need to learn how to self-regulate ourselves and get that higher brain back online. So the best partnership, or the best parent-child relationship, or the best colleague relationship is when both people really are committed to make minimizing distress and threat the top priority and optimizing security and safety and caring the top priority. And if you don't know how to do that, the commitment is we're going to learn together and try to interrupt these reactive cycles where we threaten each other and learn how to repair. So there is, it's not like everyone needs to know how to do this. They have to want to learn how to do it and find people that they care about who want to learn with them.
So give me some examples of, you know, how a couple could break out of an old drama and pattern.
An example would be they are eating dinner together, and one says something about they're going to an event, and their ex, you know, partner's going to be there. And the partner says to them, the partner who's listening, I feel insecure because I feel whenever she's around you, you know, she's very seductive still, and I feel she still wants you, and it makes me really insecure that this threat is there, even if I know you're not interested in her. Now, if that's diminished, if that report is, oh, you're too sensitive, or, you know, get over it, that woman will probably escalate because the resistance to her partner caring that she's in distress actually will make her more distressed. So the partner who's very aware will go, oh, honey, I get you're feeling insecure. You know, tell me about it. What would make it safe so I can go to this meeting and you would feel totally at ease that, you know, it's just you and me and she's no threat to us. Tell me what you need. If the partner denied that ability to care, you know, or didn't show that ability to care and minimized it, and their partner went into escalation, then that would create, you know, anything from a mild reaction to a traumatic experience if it's going to trigger some historic pain where that person was really harmed by a third-party threat.
Now, you talk about three nonverbal love languages.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about those.
Yes, well, that came out of the research showing that the primary way that a parent bonds with their child before the child can speak, the first 2 years, where most of this hardwiring is occurring primarily with the mother, who by nature is the best caregiver in the beginning years to give the child what it needs, that if the way she calms the child in secure attachment is the child cries, let's say the child's crawling and sees a piece of rope on the rug and doesn't know if it's a snake or a rope to its young awareness, and it starts crying scared, it will look to the mother, the primary caregiver, and if the mother's eyes are, you're okay, and the tone of voice is, you're okay, that's the second one. Eyes is a love language, tone of voice, soothing with a voice, and the body language is, you're okay, then the child will feel it's safe to keep going. But if the child's really afraid and should be afraid or isn't able to be quelled in that way, a secure, loving parent would pick that child up if the person, mother, father, had the instinct, hold the child close to its body, and be able to communicate, I'm here, I am your safe source, I'm your oasis in the desert of life, ropes, snakes, whatever's scaring you, I'm here to, with my eyes, hi honey, you're okay, you're safe, and soothe you with my eyes, voice, and body language. If the parent were more in the insecure style or the trauma style, the child would cry, be it out there in the crib or in the on the floor or wherever, and the parent would turn away, would either minimize, like, you know, you're not important to me, yell at the child, that would be more of the scary parent. The eyes would look scary, the body language would be rigid, the tone of voice would be overwhelming, and the child would not look to the parent anymore to regulate itself when it felt unsafe because it was too dangerous, and would learn to regulate itself. You could go, oh, there's a really healthy child at 9 months, you know, learning to take care of itself in daycare because, you know, there's no one there. But they're really actually quite anxious because they can't depend on anyone.
You say that we can use this in, you know, business relationships, colleagues, but we can hardly pick them up and hug them, can we?
We can hardly what?
Pick up and hug a colleague.
No, but oh my goodness, when I am working with someone that I know is triggered with me or I want to, you know, really have positive rapport, I'm very aware if my eyes, you know, are aggressive or reactive or threatening, my tone of voice or my body language, I'm going to most likely not have the buy-in from their deepest parts or primitive brain that I'm a safe, pro-relational, loving source to open to. So I can totally work with my nonverbals without anyone knowing. And, you know, if I'm reactive and I look scared or angry, then the person's going to pick up and respond in a defensive way.
On your website, you actually have a love style test questionnaire that people can go and find out how well they perform.
Yes. Yes, on our website, confusedaboutlove.com, up on the very first homepage, it says free love style profile quiz. It takes 5 minutes, 22 questions, and you automatically, the participant gets a report back with their responses and will help give them a general sense of where what love style, what of the four, is their dominant style or if they're a hybrid. So they'll get their scores back and begin to get some distinctions for themselves. And it describes each love style for them to see how it might be, some of their patterns might be playing out in their intimacy dynamics.
You also have some great articles there.
Yeah, we have some fun blogs that we've written about with all these different distinctions. And my partner, Lyon Goodman, also is what we playfully call. We call ourselves a recovering avoidant himself, and I'm a recovering anxious, quite well recovered, after many years of walking our talk. And we talk a lot about our own process, and he talks about being a recovered narcissist in terms of some of his male patterns. And we were very vulnerable. We wrote a lot for Your Tango, so it has some of our mentions our free love style quiz and almost all of them, but the general content is very useful. We just kind of grabbed them and posted them.
Well, before we bring the show to a close, Carissa, is there one practical suggestion or tool that couples or parents could use to interrupt a pattern of withdrawing or reacting or fighting?
Yes, when you notice you're scared, you are either being threatening in some way. In other words, the person is feeling escalated by the way you're relating to them, or you're feeling threatened. You can be totally in control of your own reactions. So you either can leave the room and reset yourself and come back in a more, you know, pro-relational brain by being aware of your eyes being more loving and more, your tone of voice being more even, your body language being more relaxed. Do what you need to reset yourself. Or if you're not triggered, be the one to lead the loving tones and attitude and gestures that will calm the other person down.
Well, and finally, Krista, can you tell us again where people can take the Love Styles test and learn more about your work?
Sure. ConfusedAboutLove.com. On the homepage, you'll see right there the free Love Style up in the upper left-hand corner, and just press it. And there it will be. Also, I work by phone, Skype. We do intensives. I do them with my partner or alone. People fly in if they are in crisis and they want a rapid transformation. Work in person or long distance through Skype, as mentioned. And anyone can heal, even the most traumatized. I have a lot of trauma in my personal history, and I have been blessed to say that I can really say most people can heal their trauma. They just have to find the right clinician and do the work they need to do to rewire themselves. And any couple can learn to rewire from insecure to secure. You just have to learn how.
Carissa Lumineer, thank you so much. I must say that this work is some of the most valuable I've ever come across. So good luck with that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Carissa Lumineer also is the author of the groundbreaking book, Parenting Begins Before Conception, which is being excerpted on inspiredparentingmagazine.com. Once again, Love Style Test, confusedaboutlove.com. That brings us to the end of this show. For advanced news of future guests, sign up for my newsletter at sedgebeer.com. The theme tune for the show is from an original song called Searching by Grammy Award-winning producer, composer and musician Barry Goldstein. I'm Sandy Sedgebeer. Thanks for joining me today. I look forward to having your company at the same time next week. Till then, don't forget you can listen to more great shows live and in our archives here at vividlife.me.
Thank you for listening to Conversation at the Cutting Edge, where scientists, researchers, authors, and teachers working at the leading edge meet. For conversations that aim to shift your perceptions about who you are, why you're here, and what you can achieve when you open your mind, expand your awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. Join us next week, same time, with your host, Sandy Sedgebeer, for another conversation at the Cutting Edge.
What does your vivid life look like? What does it feel like to be living a vivid life every single day? How do you start? What's the first step for you personally to make the shift that you've been seeking? Find out now. Vivid Life. It's a happier, healthier, wealthier state of being. Get there today by following us on Facebook, Twitter, or subscribing to our free inspirations in your inbox at vividlife.me.
You cannot separate who you are and what you do from how you interact with the world. Marketing was never meant to be slick and soulless. If you're looking to build your personal or business profile and platform and connect with the audience that resonates with you and your message, visit www.sandysedgebeer.com and discover what 30-plus years of applying the science of resonance in international publishing, marketing, and conscious business development can do.
You're listening to Vivid Life Radio Talk Radio that connects you to the most current, optimistic, and inspiring conversations on the planet. Get ready to be catapulted into your happiest, healthiest, and wealthiest life ever. Go to vividlife.me. That's vividlife.me for details on our previous and upcoming conversations with the world's brightest minds, sharing their wisdom for happier, healthier, and wealthier lives.